The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
I am Gina Mastrangeli, a member of the Worship Committee here at the Fellowship, and I personally extend a warm welcome to all of you this morning. Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a caring community that aspires to empower people to grow spiritually, to nurture one another, and to work for justice and stewardship of the earth. UUs strive to listen, learn, and grow from teachings that come from many diverse sources. Our service today is hybrid. Some of us are in our building here, located on Ridge Pike in Lower Providence Township, not far from Collegeville, Pennsylvania. Others are attending on Zoom. But whether you are with us in person or virtually online, we welcome you. We welcome you, whoever you are, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, whatever your background, your gender, identity expression, or whomever you love. We welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of love and compassion and joy. If you are a newcomer to our service online, we invite you to sign our online visitor card. The link to this card appears in the chat, and you can fill it out anytime during the service. If requested, we will send you our e-newsletter and provide you with information about our congregation. We also invite you to join us following the service for our informal online fellowship chit-chat, and today we also have a book club discussion. If you are with us here in person for the first time, please let somebody in the sanctuary know. There's Linda and Preston, who are our presidents, Anne, who is our vice president. Just let somebody know, and we'll answer any of your questions. This morning, we culminate Women's History Month by acknowledging three women, Catherine Sedgwick, Maya Angelou, and Jane Addams. These women have inspired three of our own members in some way. Catherine Sedgwick was a Unitarian. Jane Addams attended a Unitarian church. Maya Angelou lived our shared UU values. Reading and learning about other people, their adversities and struggles, their values, deliberations, and choices made, their failures and triumphs, invites opportunity for us to connect to their lives and to revisit the values that guide our lives, to rekindle the flame inside us, to reignite our commitment to what matters most to us, and to renew our faith. And renewing faith is our Soul Matters theme for March. Let us now open our service by lighting the chalice. First, Vienna Kaiser will read our chalice lighting words from her home on Zoom. Then Kay Stuhlegross will light the chalice and peace lamp here in the sanctuary. So now to Vienna on Zoom, please.
All right. We light this chalice with So Must We, written by Reverend A. Powell Davies. So far as I can see, all the great leaders and the great exemplars of religion possessed faith in life's essence, in its hidden meaning, in its moral claim, and in its rightness of its inner spiritual guidance. And by this, the great ones lived their lives. So must we. There are no problems greater than our power to solve them. There are no burdens greater than our strength. We shape by every moment of our lives the great decisions. Then let us venture still with reason as a lamp to guide us, but lighted with the light of faith.
Thank you, Vienna. I will now light the chalice flame and then the peace lamp. After I write the peace lamp, I will return to the microphone and say the words for lighting the peace lamp, may peace be with us, and we will all say together, all the people of the world. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song this morning is hymn 1028, Fire of Commitment. You at home are encouraged to sing as loud as you want. Here in the sanctuary, COVID protocols are still in place. No singing, but you are welcome to clap, move, or dance. Moment for all ages, why women's history? I'm trying something different, an experiment. We'll see if it works. We'll begin by discussing a painting by the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe. So Mike, if you could please advance to the next slide and show the viewers at home only the slide. Don't have the camera focused on me. Okay, what do you see, or really, what do you notice first? Most likely, you saw the smooth, white, enormous bone. This painting is one of the series that O'Keefe did that features sun-bleached pelvis bones. And the objects or subject matter in any drawing or painting is called the positive space. It's what the artist wants you to notice. So now, what else do you notice besides the pelvis bone? The area that surrounds the objects or the object is called the negative space. In this painting, the sky would be the negative space. And this is how an artist frames the subject. Negative space is as important as the positive space. Negative space highlights the shapes, forms, and details of the objects. Here, the expansive, clear blue sky that surrounds the pelvis bone emphasizes the bone's elegant contours, its subtle change of color and shadow. But notice that the color and the shape of the bone draws attention to the sky. The bone even has a peephole which to view a small portion of the sky. And once we let our eyes roam beyond the bone, we see a cloudless sky, and below, a small span of southwestern desert with a horizon line delineated by a mountain range. The negative space, the sky and the location, plus the positive space, that is the pelvis bone, work together to make the picture whole, to give it balance, and to tell a story. So what story do you think the painting is trying to tell? O'Keefe titled this painting Pelvis with a Distance. The sun-bleached pelvis bone that floats majestically up and diagonally across a southwestern desert sky beckons us to see the object in context, the location, the weather, and the effect of the environment on the bone, and to wonder. To O'Keefe, bone signified life and the eternal beauty of the desert. Together, the hard weathered bone and the endless blue sky over a desert present the resilience and the persistence of life and nature. So now, what does the painting mean to you? Art invites the viewer to see, reflect, and to wonder. And maybe after this very short session, your viewpoint of the picture might have changed. Maybe you can add to the story that Georgia O'Keeffe painted, or does it have another meaning for you? Okay, Mike, if you could please advance to the next slide and then focus the camera on the podium again. It doesn't have to be me, could be. So what does all this have to do with Women's History Month or Black History Month or any of the awareness days, Native American, LGBTQ+, or mental health that we dedicate a service to? Like the positive space in a picture, history tends to be told and broadcasted through the eyes of the dominant majority culture. And this is what we tend to focus on, the object before our eyes, the values, insights, and perspectives of one slice of people. As with negative space, which brings more information to us to the story that a picture tells, when we fill in the gaps with missing narratives and chronicles from groups who have not had an opportunity to tell their story, we incorporate more information. This broadens our view and gives a more complete picture of history. And as we see more and uncover blind spots, this might change how we have viewed history as told, but it does not negate it, because we cannot change how someone viewed events. But by understanding a perspective that maybe we no longer hold or agree with, If we take time to examine it, we can begin to explore the complexity of history and investigate the interactions of the various parts and people associated with the cultures and systems. From there, we can find opportunity to see the potential to improve, what to throw away, or redesign and rebuild, and create viable solutions. So in brief, why women's history? Just as noticing how the positive and negative space in a painting tell a story, and with reflection, we better understand it, by opening ourselves to women's history or any minority history, we see more. We can better understand how the parts and all the people together tell the whole story. From there, we can refocus and rethink. We can bring history into our lives. We can learn the lessons of history. We've heard that cliche quite often. And let it reawaken our values, renew our faith, and rededicate ourselves to move our ideals into action. Next, Susan Hare, Grace Smith, and Lorraine Lee will speak about a woman who has touched their lives in some way. First, Susan Hare.
Good morning. When I was first asked to participate in this service by thinking of women who have had an impact on my life, I immediately thought of my two of my aunts, one on each side of my family, who were strong, bright, professional, creative women who remained single throughout their lives. One was a musician and the other a first grade teacher. I admired both of them from a young age and even without even thinking about the fact that they were single. I always loved their visits. I decided, when I was given this assignment, to look back farther in history to find a woman who made some of those same decisions and showed their same qualities. So, who was Catherine Maria Sedgwick? Anyone heard of her? I had not. I found her. As I shared her background, noticed the strong support she received from her male relatives and colleagues through the years. She was born on December 28, 1789, in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, into a prominent New England family. Sedgwick was the sixth of seven children. Her father, a prominent lawyer and politician, took an interest in her education and provided her with a background in literature that would inspire her later development as a writer. Her mother, who appeared to battle depression, from her mother's sad example, she focused her energies on improving conditions for women in prisons and asylums. She died when Catherine was 18 and may have taken her own life. Catherine died in 1867 and was buried in the family plot in Stockbridge. Now I'll share with you some of the influence that she had in her time. Catherine's economic status as a young woman from an upper-class family contributed to her education and social circles, which provided her with the connections to write and influence. Catherine wrote many popular novels and other writings during her literary career. Male writers such as James Fenimore Cooper and William Cullen Bryant respected Sedgwick as a peer, while female authors such as Lydia Maria Child and Harriet Beecher Stowe regarded her as a literary role model. Despite her popularity and international success, Catherine's works fell into obscurity by the end of the 19th century. They were rediscovered in the 1970s as feminist researchers sought out forgotten female figures of the past who are now widely studied. One of her books, Married or Single, was published in 1857 and is considered a work of domestic fiction, which means it's written mainly for women. I had to look that up, which grew rapidly in popularity in the 19th century. Sedgwick's goal was, I quote, to change American attitudes about single women from ridicule to respect. The main theme is that the choice is not whether it's right to become married or stay single, but to marry or remain single for the right reasons. Also quoted in the book, as slaves must be trained for freedom, so women must be educated for usefulness, independence, and contentment in single life. So considered, single life would not long be regarded as either helpless, joyless, or ridiculous. And that dreaded stigma, old maid, would soon cease to be a stigma, and in the lapse of ages, possibly become obsolete. Here are some ways she lived her principles. That's how I will end my speech, my talk. Though she was engaged twice and reportedly received 6 proposals, as I mentioned earlier, Catherine chose to remain single. While she expressed ambivalence about her unmarried status, this allowed her rights she would have been denied if she'd had a husband. Under the laws of couverture, had to look that up too, which continued in various forms through the 1980s, a woman legally became one with her husband upon marriage. This was symbolized by taking his name. A married woman had no legal, political, or economic rights. She could not vote, sign contracts, own a business, or acquire her own property. Catherine, with the unwavering support of her brothers, defied convention as a respected woman in the public sphere. By remaining single, Catherine had professional independence that married women could not legally have for well over a century. The legal status of married women was a major issue in the struggle for women's suffrage. In 1821, Catherine converted from Calvinism, in which she was raised, to Unitarianism. Unitarians based their beliefs on reason, experience, and a rational interpretation of Scripture, instead of the authoritarianism and dogma of Calvinism. Encouraged by her brothers to write a moral tract on Calvinism, Catherine started work on what became her first novel. A New England Tale was first published anonymously in 1822. In a setting unmistakably modeled on Stockbridge, the vulnerable yet independent heroine must follow her conscience to find her own way in an uncertain world. I find it interesting that she chose to remain anonymous. Her religious Unitarian conversion influenced much of her literary work. She had a strong social conscience and championed religious tolerance and reform in city tenement conditions. In 1848, she became the first director of the Women's Prison Association in New York and held the position from its founding in 1854 to her death. She also founded the Society for the Aid and Relief of Poor Women. I'm intrigued with her writing talent, which reflect her principles and the fact that she is relatively unknown today. Catherine certainly represented strong ethical values in her writing and her life at her time. Her lifestyle and choices remind me of both of my beloved aunts. I have been proud to introduce her to you. And now I introduce Grace Smith.
Ah, thank you. It's nice to be here. My talk I've titled My Path to Inspiration. And I'm going to speak about Maya Angelou. And I chose to speak about my path to discovering Maya Angelou because of her belief that, as she said, it is in the search itself that one finds the ecstasy. So as a girl, I wanted to be inspired rather than overwhelmed. I really feared I'd fail if I aimed too high at the inspirational target. I worried if I chose Wonder Woman, I might possibly misplace her all-powerful lasso of truth. I wasn't the most organized preteen. So I considered other talented women, you know, Joan of Arc, the Virgin Mary, and even that rough and tumble battle axe, Tugboat Annie. But I needed to find a worldly woman, a mortal who walked the earth, who would inspire me with her passion and intelligence and her sense of justice. I wanted to be guided by real human strength. Growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area from the 1940s to the 1970s, I was drawn to the arts, to justice, to physical expression, the exotic, women who felt free to use their bodies and minds and voices to express themselves, of course. And then there she was, Maya Angelou. I mean, she was almost in my backyard. She was living nearby in the Oakland Hills. Yeah, she actually did live on this earth. How could I not have found her? Oh my God, she was awesome. A 6 foot tall black Amazon, a magnificent female giant who spoke softly, fervently, passionately, and was moved me with her powerful voice. But I wasn't always faithful to her. I'll admit that for a while, it was a battle between the forces of light and dark, because I also heard another voice, Phyllis Diller's. Do you remember her? Oh, I wish I had an image of her. They couldn't have been physically more different. Phyllis was wild and brash, a crazy blonde, that mother of 6 kids who dared to joke about divorce and her plastic surgery during her stand-up comedy routines in the San Francisco clubs in the 1950s. God, she was outrageous at a time in my life when I needed to hear a woman challenge our limited female roles. Housework can't kill you, but why take the chance? I admit I have a terrible sex drive. My boyfriend lives 50 miles away. Phyllis was a lot funnier than Dr. Maya Angelou or Betty Friedan. So for a while it was Phyllis Diller versus Maya Angelou struggling for my allegiance. Then Phyllis disappointed me when she moved on to Hollywood. She sold out. So Maya's voice won the battle. Dr. Angelou's firm, steady, moral voice rose out of a deep well filled with her life experiences. The twists of Dr. Angelou's life fascinate me. Let me just quickly list a few outside of her famous writings. Abandoned by her parents at 3, at 7 and a half, she was violently raped by her mother's boyfriend. For the next 6 years, she was mute, refusing to speak to anyone other than her brother. While mute, she memorized Shakespeare plays and sonnets and poetry of all types. At 16, a single mother, a high school dropout, she worked as a waitress, a sex worker, and then became the youngest uniformed black female San Francisco trolley car conductor. Now that's an accomplishment. Discovered, she then performed as an exotic calypso dancer, singer in nightclubs, then in films and on the world stages. Marrying, moving to Africa, she became a newspaper editor in Cairo, next a freedom fighter in Ghana. Then returning to New York, she was the right-hand woman for both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. She was an outspoken demonstrator for Fidel Castro and against apartheid. Poet, author, public speaker. Meanwhile, she was a writer and producer of PBS documentaries about black history. The national poet for President Clinton's inauguration. Toss-in college professor and consultant, twice married, many lovers, endless gay friends, a mentor to students, yet always exotic. I can be changed by what happens to me, but I refuse to be reduced by it. Yes, she became my Wonder Woman. As you suspect, I acquired few of Dr. Angelou's powers, but she did lay down breadcrumbs on a path for me. I followed her intriguing trail, gazing out at the peaks that she had climbed and the fields that she had plowed, and at the creation's wisdom and compassion that she modeled. And I paid attention. She both calmed and energized me. In fact, I am able to stand here right now because she modeled how to accept a worthy challenge rather than to retreat in anxiety and fear. My fantasy, previously private, is that Dr. Angelou, were she to have met me, would say to me her famous words, "Grace," and she would call me Grace, "you alone are enough. You have nothing to prove to anybody." And I would answer with her words, "My mission in life is not merely to survive, but to thrive, to do so with passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style. So may it be." And now let me introduce Lorraine Lee.
Good morning, everyone. Many of you who know me know that the one issue which overrides all others for me is world peace. So when Gina asked me to be part of today's service and to select a woman who has been an inspiration for me, the choice was easy: Jane Addams. When I was growing up, my parents, who were quite politically active, taught me about Jane Addams. Let me share some things about her. Laura Jane Addams was born into wealth and privilege on September 6, 1860, excuse me, in Cedarville, Illinois. Her father, John Addams, ran a successful mill business. Jane was eighth of nine children, four of whom did not survive to adulthood. Her mother died in childbirth when Jane was just 2 years old. Her father went on to marry Anna Haldeman, a widow with two children. Jane's father was a friend of Abraham Lincoln, served as a state senator, and was a conductor on the Underground Railroad. As Jane approached adulthood, she had set her sights on attending Smith College, and she was accepted. However, her father did not want her that far from home and directed her to attend Rockford Seminary instead. There she learned to write well and also to give public speeches. However, she was not certain what she wanted to do with her life, so tried attending medical school in Philadelphia. Women's medical, by the way, for all of us who live in this area. Personal health issues cut that short. Next, she decided to take a trip abroad, which many of her social class did, in order to decide what to do with their lives. I think that meant look for a husband. Anyway, the trip proved to be an eye-opening experience for her. She was stunned by the poverty she witnessed and vowed to do her part to help end the suffering of the poor. On a second trip to Europe, she saw the German Cathedral of Humanity, a place where people could come for help with basic needs, including cultural development. Inspired by what she saw, the Cathedral for Humanity became the model for Hull House, which she founded with Ellen Gates Starr in the city of Chicago. They bought a large building in an underprivileged area of the city. They moved in and got to work. They set up a kindergarten class, programs and lectures for children and adults, provided vital services such as finding jobs for the unemployed, caring for the sick, and supplying food and clothing to the needy. Adams and Starr soon recognized the need for social reform in order to make life better for the people in the Hull House neighborhood and beyond. For example, they worked to change child labor laws. Many of the children they served worked 60 hours per week. Starr and Adams' campaign for passage of the Factory Act, which limited the numbers of hours children could be employed. They also worked on improving conditions in mental hospitals and poorhouses, creating a juvenile court system, and promoting the unionization of working women. They also worked on reforming employment agencies, many of which were corrupt at that time. Nothing escaped their notice, including the issue of uncollected garbage, which Adams described as spreading vermin and disease. In 1895, Adams went to the City Hall to protest the way garbage was handled and came away the new garbage inspector of the Ninth Ward. Eventually, Adams drew the attention of President Theodore Roosevelt, who actually visited her at Hull House. With this kind of notoriety, Adams continued to be an incredible social reformer. Can you believe she was an ardent supporter of women's suffrage? She also was committed to racial equality and became one of the founders of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The ugly spectacle of World War I caused Adams to speak up for world peace, even though she was reviled by many for her anti-war stance. She toured Europe and spoke up for the humane treatment of all children who were affected by the devastation of the war. This included her call to feed even the German children. During the 1920s, Adams continued to be a strong voice for world peace. She served as one of the founders of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, an organization which still exists today with many chapters throughout the world. A heart attack suffered in 1926 forced her to curtail some of her activities. But her greatest honor was yet to come. In 1931, she was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace in recognition of her worldwide activism in support of world peace. A few years later, in 1935, Adams died of intestinal cancer, which had gone undiagnosed and untreated. Today, I am proud to stand in the same arena with Jane Addams. It is an honor to follow in her footsteps. And now we will have a musical selection by our own Christine Perry.
Tell me,
you want a woman who's got more than just a man.
Tell me,
you want a woman with her own imagination.
Tell me,
and if I don't listen, tell me again. I need to hear it. I need to know. I need to hear it for me.
handicapped more than just a man.
Tell me.
And you want a woman with her own imagination.
Tell me.
And if I don't listen, tell me again.
Tell me.
You want a woman with inspiration.
Tell me.
You want a woman who's got more than just a man.
Tell me.
You want a woman with her own imagination.
Tell me.
And if I don't listen, tell me again.
Tell me.
We've now come to the part in our service where you are invited to share briefly a joy or a concern. We will call on people in the sanctuary first to come to the microphone, and then Mike McNeil will instruct those on Zoom. If you do not want to speak on Zoom, you're welcome to write in chat and Mike will read. While you are gathering your thoughts, please enjoy the musical interlude. It's a snippet from Concertino for Flute 107 by the female composer Cécile Chaminade. Okay, and we will close it with Carol McDade's Come Sing a Song with Me.
Thank you.
Deva Kaiser will read our closing words. She's on Zoom this morning.
The closing words this morning as we extinguish the chalice are by Reverend Douglas Taylor. Help us to know, despite the messy complexity of life, that we do not labor in vain, that peace will one day prevail, that perseverance will be rewarded, and that hope is a powerful response.
Thank you, Deva. I will now extinguish the flame of both the chalice and the peace lamp. May peace be with us and all the people of the world.
Thank you. Our closing hymn is 1014, Standing on the Side of Love. At home, please join in and sing. Here, feel free to clap, move, dance. And after the closing song, Sherry Milkey will give the announcements.
The promise of the Spirit.